Do the right thing. So easy, yet not. Ethics on Wall Street today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl, the 5th of April, today, Wednesday. Good as always to have you here, everybody. Big picture is where we are going to start today. Context stuff about our current macroeconomic status that comes to us, interestingly enough, from you. The New York Fed reports that total outstanding household debt in this country is right about where it was in 2008, a year in which, if you recall, nothing good happened economy-wise. Now, having debt is fine. Too much debt? Yeah, no. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore digs into what these numbers might be telling us.
Current household debt in the U.S. is at just about $12.6 trillion. That's how much we're all taking out in loans. It's 1% shy of the 2008 record.
That's a milestone that it's taken 9 years for us to achieve.
Andy Howitt is a research economist at the New York Fed. There are pluses and minuses to this. You need a certain amount of debt and credit to have a well-functioning economy.
Increasing debt is a sign of optimism for the future because people believe that to make these debts, they must be able to pay them off in the future. So all that's good.
But Howitt says too much debt can, of course, lead to instability. And America's debt today is very different from America's debt around the start of the recession. On the one hand, it's held by people with higher credit scores, so that's good. On the other hand,
debt now is considerably more heavily weighted toward auto debt and student loans.
Mortgage debt is still the largest type of debt households have, for sure, but it's $1 trillion lower than it was a decade ago. Student loan debt, though, that's increased 170% in 10 years as more people go to school and school gets more expensive. Adam Levitin teaches law at Georgetown.
There's a concern that student loan debt is kind of being a dead weight that will be having a downward pull on consumer investment generally.
There's some indication, according to Fed research, that may be happening. Students who went into debt to get an associate's or bachelor's degree are noticeably less likely to own a home by their 30s than students who did not go into debt. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
The corporate story of this Wednesday is the most expensive American restaurant deal ever. Panera, a bakery-cafe combo thing in that getting crowded, healthy, fast, casual space, has been bought by the European private equity group JAB for $7.2 billion American dollars. JAB is no stranger to customers in this country, though those customers might not know it. It owns Pete's Coffee, Stumptown, and Intelligentsia Coffees as well, and chains like Krispy Kreme Donuts. Marketplace's Andy Euler explains what's going on.
Over the past few years, Panera has invested more than $40 million to get its food to people more efficiently. Technology upgrades improved online and mobile orders. Chris Johnson lives outside of D.C. and says he's used the Panera app a lot, even ordered with it every day when his second child was born.
It's easier. You know, you type it in. You don't have to wait online. You get there, your food's waiting for you. And it's the best thing is you can see all the options. So you're not asking the person if they can take the tomatoes out.
That's one factor that's helped Panera grow more than most restaurants of late. The industry's been sluggish for the past couple of years. Bonnie Riggs is a restaurant analyst at the NPD Group. She says even more than the mobile app, people go to Panera because of the menu.
In our data, we had 34% of consumers who said that they go to Panera for a healthy light meal, which jumped 4 points in a year. And I've not seen performance like that.
Panera's new owner is JAB, a German family-owned investment company. It's been on a food and restaurant spending spree, including buying the bagel chain Einstein Brothers in 2014 and Krispy Kreme Donuts last year. Sarah Senator follows restaurants for the firm Bernstein.
It's consistent with their strategy so far in terms of what other acquisitions they've made, which are largely, you know, coffee and baked goods stores.
JAB isn't expected to change much about Panera after the deal's done. The company paid a 30% premium on the current stock price, so Panera could keep up what it's doing. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
With President Trump due to meet Chinese President Xi Jinping down in Florida tomorrow, we turn now to the geopolitics of corporate bankruptcy. There are some concerns being expressed in political Washington about Chinese investors maybe making a bid for the nuclear reactor division of now bankrupt Westinghouse Electric and its attendant technologies. As with many things China-related, especially since the campaign, Marketplace's Adam Allington explains that Chinese investment in the United States right now, it's complicated.
Last year, foreign direct investment in the U.S. by Chinese companies tripled to $46 billion. Now, some lawmakers are concerned, as they tend to be when some foreign countries try to snap up American companies and their technology.
It's all very similar to 20, 30 years ago when the Japanese came in.
Linda Lim is a professor of strategy at the University of Michigan. She says foreign investment creates jobs, fosters innovation, and countries that trade with one another are much less likely to go to war.
We have to take a long-term view. So 20 or 30 years, yeah, the main benefit is that the Chinese learn, I guess you would say, how to do things the American way, which is what we want, right?
The exception to this rule, however, are deals that might impact national security. This is where China is different from, say, Germany or the UK.
There's a difference between an ally and a pure competitor with a stated intention of challenging American hegemony.
Daniel Rosen is a partner with the research group Rhodium. He says there are multiple reasons the U.S. wouldn't want China to acquire sensitive technology. Its relationship with North Korea, for one. But in the cases where the government does step in, he says the reasons should be clear and direct.
It's very important that we make clear to potential investors in the future, both Chinese and others, how the U.S. system works.
Now, China has imposed capital controls on its companies. Rosen says he expects the level of Chinese investment to stay high, but not increase. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
Wall Street Today, blame Paul Ryan and the Fed. How about that? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. More evidence today, as if we really needed it, that Amazon does indeed intend to buy, sell, or process basically everything. The company has made a $50 million deal with the NFL to stream this season's Thursday night football games. We got our senior tech correspondent Molly Wood into the studio today to make me smart on all things Amazon. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Kai.
So let's talk football first with this Amazon deal. I mean, that's a lot of money.
Are you ready for some football? It is.
You've been planning that one.
See what I did there?
You had a morning to figure that one out. Right?
You know, sadly, it just came to me. That's how plugged in I am to the football universe. It is a lot of money, although one astute analyst pointed out that since it's tied to Amazon Prime, Amazon would have to pick up only 500,000 new Prime subscribers to make back the money.
Which they'll get with football like that, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's almost no reason that they couldn't pick up that many and then make back the money. And then on top of that, you know, people have been comparing it to the Twitter deal. Twitter obviously paid a lot less for streaming rights. But most of Amazon streaming, I would warrant, happens on televisions.
Actual television.
Actual televisions through the Fire Stick or, you know, some other Amazon device. And that is, frankly, a much more appealing prospect than streaming football on your computer.
Talk to me for a second, though, about Amazon Prime and Amazon Video as, I mean, those are now becoming sort of the go-tos.
They are becoming a lot more popular, I think, than even I expected, because Amazon was slow to have as much content as, say, Apple or Netflix or Hulu. And they arguably still don't, but they're making really great original content. They're, you know, I mean, Amazon is so fascinating because they got into TV and you thought, well, they're not doing it right. Well, now, you know, however many years later, they are.
So when Jeff Bezos started this company, let's remember, it used to be an online bookstore for crying out loud, right? Now it's everything to everyone. And obviously you can't argue with success, but there has to be a limit.
I am starting to wonder about the limits. I mean, I made before we came in here a partial list of that. I'm not going to read them all because it goes on too long. But there's all of the retail stuff. Now there's physical retail. They invested in a fuel cell business this week.
That's what I'm saying, right?
I mean, you could argue that they're getting a little far afield. You could also argue that we are quickly closing in on a time when nothing that you do in the digital world won't somehow touch or pay Amazon.
Explain that, right? Because that's the cloud services and AWS, Amazon Web Services, all of that.
Most of the websites that you already go to run through Amazon. Increasingly, their devices are actually coming into your home. You know, they're delivering groceries.
Yep.
You will at some point not conduct business online without Amazon getting a cut of it. And so they've been very good at slow and steady execution so far. If they make money off everything you do online, there may be no such thing as stretched too thin.
I saw a great quote from Bezos the other day in which he said, you know, I've lost billions of dollars on stuff that I've tried and hasn't worked. But if you're afraid of risk, get out of this business. And I'm making much more money with the stuff we tried and has worked.
Said the guy who's also going to space.
Right. I mean, not coincidentally.
Yeah. He's taken a lot of risks. Yeah. And you know, Amazon's at over $800, twice the market cap of Walmart. And at least one analyst says 1,000 is no problem.
All right. Brief detour here in the remaining moments that we have left. It is tax season. We did, as you may or may not know, Molly and I do a podcast. It's called Make Me Smart. This was the tax episode this week. I'm going to throw a number out at you and you're going to fact check it for me. You ready? You know where I'm going. 74,000.
The purported number of pages in the American tax code. And one of the many fact checks on our show is that it's not 74,000 pages. It's only 2,600 pages. But there are an additional, 71,000 pages to explain the 2,600.
Well, the math almost worked
out. That and many. Math is not my thing. I'm a journalist. That and many more pieces of information in this week's episode of Make Me Smart.
Sign up, register, iTunes, subscribe, do all that good stuff. Bye.
Bye.
We talked a little bit yesterday on the program about Erie, Pennsylvania, Erie proper, specifically the city, and how it's dealing with a changing economy and lost manufacturing jobs. Younger tech entrepreneurs is the short answer. Today, we go out into Erie County in the town of Cory, Pennsylvania, population about 6,000 or so, where the economic changes look a little bit different. Back in the day, all right, way back, Cory was an oil town and the home of the Climax Locomotives Company. It was a manufacturing city then and now, which means it's counting on the Trump administration to give it a boost in this new economy. So today, as part of our series, The Big Promise, small business owners who are trying to bring downtown Cory back one store at a time. Marketplace's Rima Kreis has that one.
Wendy Neckers and Valerie Beckerink are sisters, both in their 50s. And when I ask them about growing up around Cory...
Oh, that's opening up a Pandora's box, isn't it?
She has a far better memory than I do.
The one with the better memory is Valerie, the younger sister. She remembers as a kid making the 10-mile pilgrimage to downtown Cory.
I rode my horse to the Dairy Queen.
You know, when she was bored of riding her bike. She also remembers...
Our grandmother used to come and buy us parakeets and canaries at, was it Murphy's?
Oh, yeah. That's right. I forgot about that.
Each one of us girls one, and we would love them until they passed away.
To a child, downtown Cory felt big and magical, but really, it stretches only a few blocks. And today, like so many main streets in so many small rural towns, it's lost a lot of its magic. The sisters and a few other small business owners are trying to turn that around. There's a trendy shop for home decor, a children's clothing boutique. And 2 years ago, Wendy opened The Painted Finch, an art gallery with a bright storefront. There are paintings, photographs.
Wood bowls, wood-turned pieces, pottery, ceramics. We have sculpture.
A painter herself, Wendy says she built the gallery to support local artists.
We're trying to create a culture here that wasn't necessarily in existence.
Give people something beautiful to look at, says Valerie.
Because it does feel a little bit like this whole area has kind of had their, their dreams are sucked out. You're just too busy trying to live.
And that can put a $500 oil painting or a $50 ceramic bowl out of reach for a lot of people. Wendy says The Painted Finch isn't making a profit yet. Still, that didn't stop her from opening another store next door a couple months ago. Epiphany's Emporium carries cowhide rugs, handbags, jewelry. Her little sister is managing it.
As soon as I committed to the landlord about renting the space, I said, this is not a good idea. But thank heaven she loves her sister.
Wendy also loves her town. That's why after she closes up shop today, she's meeting with four women who, let's just say, understand her. It's easy to mistake this gathering for a group of girlfriends getting together over wine, dishing out the latest news. But this is the Downtown Cory Business Association, established in 2016. And there's a lot on the agenda today, like organizing a breakfast fundraiser at 7 a.m. on a Sunday.
Sunday? Come on, that's my only day off. Really?
Hey.
I'm playing waitress, so do I have to be there at 7? Because I'm not cooking.
Waitress? It's buffet, honey.
Mickey Hammond, the one who's not cooking, says the fundraisers pay for First Fridays, a monthly event the group started to bring people downtown for food, live music, and shopping.
It was a good experience last year, don't you think? And we were really flying by the seat of our pants.
Hammond owns Pippets, the high-end children's store. She says customers outside of Cory always ask her,
why are you here? Because I live here. Yeah, I live here.
These women realize what they and Cory are up against, but they've got a strategy. Cory is located off Route 6, along what's known as the Artisan Trail, a series of small towns with galleries and antique shops that attract tourists vacationing on Lake Erie. Hammond says summer is coming.
I just want to roll out the welcome mat. So when they come around the corner, they look at my downtown and they think, ooh, I want to see what's in every single one of those places.
And maybe, she says, they'll find some magic. In Cory, Pennsylvania, I'm Rima Crace for Marketplace.
Coming up.
The measurement of success is boredom, where your company is not in the pages for misconduct.
Well, he's got a point, right? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is off 41 points today, 0.2%, closed at 20,648. The NASDAQ down 34, about 0.6%, 58.64. The S&P 500 shed 7 points, 0.3%, 23.52. Panera Bread, we told you about, up 14.2% today. Andy was mentioning that premium that JAB is going to pay. Agrochemical giant Monsanto grew just under 1% today on better-than-expected quarterly profits and sales. Banks were in the doldrums. J.P. Morgan Chase off 1.25%. Wells Fargo down 0.4%, which gets us to this. House Speaker Paul Ryan said today, tax reform is basically nowhere close to getting done, which traders did not care for. Also, in the minutes of the most recent Fed meeting released today, we learned some on the Federal Open Market Committee think stock valuations might be, quote, quite high, which traders also didn't like being traders. You're listening to Marketplace. Tell a friend about a podcast you think they are going to love. Right now, think of somebody you care about. What podcast do you think they would really enjoy listening to?
And once you've got it in your head, go do this in real life. Or you could do it on social media. If they don't know how to listen to a podcast, show them how to download one. And please tell us what you recommended with the hashtag TryPod. That's TryPod. And thank you for spreading the word.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. If your commute to work today was a drag, spare a thought, would you, for the people of Atlanta who are now on day 6 of dealing with the aftermath of that big bridge collapse on I-85. Workarounds are being found, yes, reroutings and detours. Spare another thought, though, for businesses in the vicinity, which are stuck where they are as customers pass them by. LEU reports now from WABE.
A live band plays at Fat Matt's Rib Shack, a popular barbecue joint in Atlanta, where only a few tables are filled. The restaurant is about a half a mile away from where the I-85 bridge collapsed last week after a massive fire shutting down part of the freeway and some nearby roads. Since then, business has been slow here, says Matt Kane, Fat Matt's nighttime manager.
For the most part, we've been dead. It'll sprinkle in here and there, but yeah, it's definitely changed.
Kane says the restaurant's seen about a 50% drop-off in customers, and he's had to let employees off early because of the lull. He says that pretty much never happens, especially on the weekends.
We usually have a line out the door, sometimes to the road, which I wish they wouldn't line up in the street, but what are you going to do? They want ribs.
Down the road on the other side of the bridge collapse, a big liquor store had to be evacuated because of the fire. No one was injured in the collapse. One person has been charged with arson in connection with the fire. When the liquor store that was evacuated reopened, manager Stephanie Brown says sales took a hit. People just couldn't get there easily by car.
So we had a lot of customers like walking to get to us and then riding their bicycles to come get to us, which is great. But, you know, they're customers that would, you know, typically buy like a couple cases. And so then they could only buy like a couple bottles. So
Jeffrey Netter is a professor of finance at the University of Georgia. He says, yeah, businesses around where the bridge shut down will be affected for a while.
Say a restaurant or a hotel, I mean, they're in major trouble.
About 250,000 cars traveled over the bridge every day. Without it, Netter says that's a huge change to people's commutes as well as business logistics. He says that while the problem is temporary, the collapse also affects the city's image.
And Atlanta already is known as a commuting nightmare to some extent, and this makes that view worse.
He says it needs to be fixed fast for the sake of the business environment. Back at Fat Matt's Rib Shack, manager Matt Kane agrees. He's thinking about how the collapse will affect rib sales in the months ahead.
I mean, 4th of July, Labor Day, Memorial Day, those are our three big days. You know what I mean? So that would be pretty bad.
State officials say they're hoping to get the I-85 bridge fixed by mid-June. In Atlanta, I'm Ellie Yu for Marketplace.
Consider the banking industry, all the jobs it takes to run that slice of the American economy. Loan officer comes to mind. Teller is another one. Financial analyst, yes. Various and sundry executives, fine. What about, though, an ethicist? Turns out that's become a banking job, too. Dr. David Miller directs the Faith and Work Initiative at Princeton University. He is also the resident ethicist at Citigroup. Thanks for coming on the program.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
So I'll tell you what, we saw that story about you in the Wall Street Journal, and we said we have to talk to this guy and find out what a bank ethicist does. What do you do when you're at Citigroup?
I'm not as interested in questions of audit and compliance and legal and regulatory restrictions. So what I am interested in and what I focus on is a few things. One is sometimes there might be an event-specific dilemma where a certain circumstance arrives is with a particular customer or client. Other times it's stepping back and evaluating more systemically or culturally. Are we creating an environment where people will flourish and be inclined to do the right thing? And we could take as an example, it's public domain information. Wells Fargo appears not to have done a good job at that, that they created a culture despite all their wonderful value statements, and I'm sure lots of mostly excellent, fine individuals. The culture certainly seemed to bend people towards misbehavior and conduct.
But how do you, not to keep banging on Wells Fargo, but let's say the CEO of Wells Fargo calls you up and says, David, we need some help, man. What's your methodology? How do you do what you do?
At the risk of sounding a bit cheeky, what I first seek
to find out is
are they serious?
Oh, yeah.
There's a lot of people who have the platitudes and the right sayings, and they maybe they mean it, maybe they don't, or is it just lip service? So the first thing I try to do is find out, are they serious?
Yeah.
And if so, to expect a carte blanche to ask any question I want to whomever I want.
We should say here, and I probably should have started with this, you know whereof you speak. You spent some time in finance when you were young.
Yeah, so I spent I started my career with IBM for 8 years in the States and then spent 8 years in London. So my British friends would tease and say I'm a poacher turned gamekeeper. So I know of, as you say, where the pressures, the realities of being in senior positions and other middle and junior positions as well, that the intensity of competition, the excitement, the allure of much of it, but also what I call the ethical gray zone. Sometimes the context that we're in, the water in which we swim might be hot or cold. It might motivate us towards more ethical behavior or motivate us towards less ethical behavior. That's where the interesting action is.
Wall Street is all about results and measurement and quantifying how well you're doing, literally on a balance sheet. I ask that, or I state that, because it seems to me the problem for you is measuring success, because success for you is the absence of scandal, right? The absence of bad things.
Yeah, the measurement of success is boredom,
right.
Where your company is not in the pages for misconduct. But frankly, banks should, as all organizations, they should measure things. They should seek to have appropriate profits. They're performing a public service. They need to be healthy and vibrant. But these things can be measured. There's lots of by these things, I mean questions of ethics and culture. And there's a variety of very interesting research going on in the academic community that's looking at, and I think organizations now are beginning to say, help us think this through. How can we draw on some of the rich traditions of the humanities, let's say, and how can we apply that to our people and our organizations? Because after all, Citibank and every other bank is comprised of people who have human emotions and behaviors and realities.
David Miller runs the Faith and Work Initiative at Princeton University. He's a specialist in business ethics. Mr. Miller, thanks very much for your time, sir.
Pleasure being with you. Thanks for inviting me.
final note on the way out today, which, should it come to pass, would be something of a milestone. General Electric, reports the Wall Street Journal today, is thinking about selling off its residential light bulb business. Yes, GE, Thomas Edison's company, the guy who invented the light bulb, perhaps selling. Also, just as a quick follow from yesterday and our story, it's now more than 40 companies that have pulled their ads from Bill O'Reilly's show on Fox News. All right, we got to go. The Dow off 41 points today, 0.2%. NASDAQ down 34 points, 0.6%. The S&P 500 off 7 points, about 0.3% there. Chris Clark, Brad Fisher, Jake Gorski, Bill Lynch, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.